Welcome to the Crate and Crowbar, episode 104, being recorded on the 4th of August. I'm Marsh Davis. I'm joined tonight by the two Toms. I speak of none other than Tom Francis.
Hello.
And Tom Senior.
Yellow.
Two Toms, double the Tomage, which means twice as many people called Tom in a room at the same time.
And half as much fun.
It's also Chris's birthday.
Hey, happy birthday, Chris.
Yeah, so fuck him. and he is at the International at the moment, which is an exciting thing that's occurring. There's also Gamescom happening. Loads of stuff, loads of games stuff happening. Today was a big slew of trailers from the Microsoft conference. Mm. Did you see any of them?
Saw all of them, and some of them were exciting, perhaps.
I've written some names down here. Should we go through them?
Yeah, let's do it.
Dark Souls 3.
Yeah.
I didn't watch that. I might play it, but... it's not. There's no point in me watching a trailer because I haven't played the previous two, really.
Well, no, I'm really excited about it, but I wouldn't even bother watching the trailer, to be honest. There's so little you can really tell about how much I'm going to like it from those trailers.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not really giving... I know Chris was quite keen to big up the amount of kind of mechanical information we've been given so far, but none of it really sells me on the game. Like, nothing is... show me that it's changed in some kind of substantial and interesting way, which I think the series probably needs to do rather than just keep on playing the same furrow.
What do you think about...
even though I like that furrow.
What do you think about it versus Bloodborne? Because I haven't played Bloodborne, but I've... or indeed Dark Souls, really. but I've read a lot about how it kind of... the lack of a shield and the replacement of that with a pistol and the way it rewards you for hyper-aggression... is sort of generally seen as a net positive, sort of like fixing a problem with Dark Souls.
So I'm not sure it's fixing a problem. It's definitely changing the system in Dark Souls, and I think that's why it's such a good game, is because it doesn't do... I mean, it borrows enough of the stuff that makes the Souls series interesting, but it also switches around enough stuff to make it really exciting and interesting and new.
Really exciting in PvP as well, because it's so fast, and the dodge move is so quick that there's a lot of kind of twitch skill to PvP combat. There's a lot of skill to Dark Souls, but it felt... Dark Souls and Dark Souls 2, it feels more about the build you have than the actual kind of twitch skill you have in a fight.
The trailer was very noticeable in showing off quite a lot of... the trailer for Dark Souls 3, this is, showed a lot of movement in combat, which wasn't really necessarily a feature of the Dark Souls game. So maybe they've decided that the fast movement is a way to go and in combat, dodging around things, rolling around things.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of faster rolling, faster dodging. There's also...
Dark Rolls.
Dark Rolls. there's also a short bow, which apparently is like quite a rapid fire weapon, but also almost a close range weapon. Which the bow's always had a weird problem in Dark Souls. Of like, I always felt like I was cheating when I was using one because I'd have to hide in a corner and very slowly aim one.
So there's a really interesting article on Gama Sutra written about the design of Bloodborne's Hunter pistol and the problems that this guy thinks it was solving in Dark Souls, and he reckons it was to solve both the fact that shields make you very passive. And the fact that bows are kind of like almost feel like an exploit, like you can, in fact, they are used for many exploits.
Cases,
And he reckons that those are two separate problems that they're trying to solve on the team, and then they realise the solution to them could be the same thing, which is a short range, long range weapon that is also works like has the parry effect of the shield, but doesn't have any other defensive advantages of the shield.
I do quite like the fact you can cheese things in the Dark Souls game using a bow, though, partly because. They're too hard for me. But also because it's a really good way of allowing people to progress while making them still feel like a shit heel. There's no way you can misinterpret that battle as a victory, even though you've killed them.
I think you can cheese manners, can't you, by being on a ledge and just firing into a random dark point below you, and for some reason the level geometry means that it will hit him.
I
only play Axiom Verge. That's the only boss battle-y game that I played to any extent, and I felt like that each boss was just figure out how to exploit it, like sort of almost that you couldn't fight a base on, so you have to just find the one place where you can stand where you can shoot it without being hit back.
Tomb Raider, otherwise known as Tombs of War. Let's fuck everything
a lot of
up.
Death, a lot of
is it a violent trailer?
It's just exclusively murdering dudes, basically, in a variety of extremely horrific ways.
But in beautiful places.
Yeah.
Really beautiful places.
In a way, that sounds more promising than last... what we've seen so far has just been her falling down slopes. And like, for fuck's sake, I've had my fill of falling down slopes.
Yeah, no, it's fine. I watched the gameplay trailer, which showed off a really lengthy kind of stealth and then kind of free combat section in quite a large expansive area. I was very excited about it. Then I realised that wasn't actually the trailer. I think that was some kind of separately revealed thing. So it was the trailer, and it's just this, you know, press forward to watch Lara tumble down sort of an escarpment over and over again. So I don't know, it's going to be a game of two halves, one of which is shit. But
it's a weird sort of conflict at the heart of The Last Tomb Raider. Is that the thing it's pilloried for on the narrative side is that she's basically a mass murderer. But that's also probably the best thing about it mechanically. Yeah, the combat's actually really quite good.
It did look really fun, actually, all the stabbing you doing this.
They did talk about having much larger areas. Mm. Like, they said five times the size or something of the areas in the previous game.
Level up by, you know, killing wolves.
And then sit above fire and think about what you've done before game, unlocking the experience.
While saving.
Delivering a monologue about, I don't really like wolves.
Yeah, hopefully. I was pleased to see her actually raiding tombs and stuff. Mm. It feels like it's Lara with a purpose as opposed to Lara finding herself, which is more interesting to me, personally.
Crackdown, which isn't a PC game, but it's interesting because it's got full-scale city demolition, which is powered by the cloud.
Yeah, I still
the cloud is probably PCs.
That's yeah, exactly.
Just what a wizard would say. So I automatically don't trust it. Even though I've now seen footage in the latest trailer that looks seriously impressive in terms of building destructibility.
Entire skyscrapers toppling over into other skyscrapers.
Smashing other houses and stuff like a giant Somebody Godzilla room, game. Yeah.
It does look awesome. What do you think the game mechanic sort of like interplay? Like, is that an interesting thing from a gameplay perspective?
Not if going by the historical precedent of the Crackdown series, which has been only accidentally good. I don't know. I imagine it's just a kind of messy sandbox, really, rather than any kind of structured. Although it does seem to have, it seems to hint at some kind of Shadow of Mordor style crime network which you can take down, but I don't know how it works.
They should have a lot of lines connecting a lot of buildings without ever explaining what any of, which is what a wizard would do. It's like they're trying to sell us these games and who knows about
it's apparently
what
it's going to blow up your idea of video games.
Oh, not again.
I think it said like blow up the way you play games.
Oh, is that
like,
right?
It implied that whatever you currently get pleasure from, you'll no longer be able to get pleasure from. It's all over now.
Yeah.
That was a lovely bit of tech, though, because as we were saying, we were watching it just before the podcast. It looks just chunky enough to be believable.
Yeah.
The way the physics just kind of slightly clips into itself is actually not a problem, but just, you know, exciting in the sense that actually that looks legit.
What about Halo Wars 2, which is a Windows 10 exclusive?
Oh, God.
Apparently. Man. Well, for PC.
But it's by Creative Assembly?
Yes. Amazing.
Which is exciting. I know so little about Halo Wars, the first one. Was it 2009? Was it made by Ensemble Studios?
I forget who it was made by, who were quickly shuttered afterwards, I'm afraid.
Yeah, they closed down. Was it console only, Halo Wars?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
It was meant to be, there was a period where for some reason people making console games decided they really wanted to crack that problem and make an RTS for the console.
Yeah, there are a few.
Well, you just don't bother. Just make a different game.
It briefly became my sideline was reviewing RTSs on consoles because the console guys didn't have any RTS people. They could only really give the complete outsider's perspective. So I reviewed like Supreme Commander on console and Supreme Commander 2 and one other, I can't remember what it was. But none of them work.
I did play one which had a kind of a cool kind of unit selection thing where you kind of flick the analog stick in a direction, your kind of control would leap to whatever movement unit was in that direction.
I think Subcon 2 you could kind of like paint what you wanted to select, so you sort of smeared around some selection juice and then when you released the thing it would select everything that would be coated in your selection juice.
Like Splatoon.
I gather that's how Halo Wars worked as well.
Really?
Kind of you just use an analog stick to gesture at the thing and smear it in selection juice.
What do you think about it being Windows 10 exclusive then? Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think that it's due out in late 2016. So hopefully by then everyone will have uncovered the various ways in which Windows 10 will try and steal your data.
Yeah. That sounds fun fucking terrifying. The internet,
which does sound terrifying.
It has complete access to everything you type.
Oh my God.
In order to build dictionaries, it says, but it's still kind of sending that data off somewhere. I don't want that.
Yeah,
I think when all this stuff came out, it became immediately apparent why Windows 10 is free. to me. Like,
it's a fucking virus.
they just gain so much information out of the people that are using it all the time, and that is just valuable data. Even if they turn that into a product or just sell it on, that's hugely valuable.
I'll upgrade to it at the same time, at the same point that I upgraded to Windows 8, which is never. Yeah. Die on Windows 7, fuck you.
I can't risk it, because it took them 3 years to get compatibility with my Wacom tablet working with Windows 7 properly. So I don't want to risk waiting 3 years for my tablet to work again.
They've really trained me not to trust or buy their new products.
I think the Windows 10 thing is the kind of the wrist lock they have on you is DirectX 12. And when games start requiring that, which is of course exclusive to Windows 10.
Yeah, I mean, so the big Vista exclusive that caused so much pain was Just Cause 2, right? Mm. And Just Cause 3 is on the horizon now, so I really hope they don't make that DX12 exclusive. Mm. It feels like there are just certain companies out there who are like weak to Microsoft's attacks. They just do whatever Microsoft wants.
Homefront, the revolution. Really?
Didn't it looks like...
But yeah, well, the previous Homefronts are rubbish, obviously, but, you know, this looks like it's... Far Cry 3, basically, but in a city with like, more misery and casual racism.
Yeah.
More casual racism.
I'm kind of fine with that. The premise doesn't bother me. It's just but based on the clips they were showing, like, the execution of it doesn't look terribly exciting. And so, as a shooter, it doesn't look very exciting.
Yeah, well, I wondered if that was... The look speed on it seemed really, really insanely slow. Like, when he was turning, which was, like... So that's obviously something you can adjust. So I don't know if actual combat's going to be as sluggish as it looks there, whether they were doing that because maybe that makes better video. If people are twitching around all the time, it probably doesn't make a good kind of cinema.
Was this completely unannounced before today?
No, I think we all knew it was happening.
Ages, yeah.
Because I met someone who was working on it at Develop, and I wondered afterwards, was he supposed to tell me he was working on that? Because I hadn't heard it existed.
It supposedly has some sort of territorial... fighty over places mechanics.
As they would describe it.
This is Far Cry 3's
this is like base capture stuff.
Base capture, yeah. Yeah, exactly, like,
yeah,
like
that's
that.
Weird, that's fun. That's fun.
And apparently the different factions all fight independently of you.
I like that. I like some of that as well. It's just really fucking brown.
Yeah, it did look quite brown. Yeah. Oh. We Happy Few?
Oh yeah, I quite like the look of that.
Yeah,
spooky kind of Bioshocky vibe to it. Not quite sure exactly what the structure of the game is, but you seem to be wandering around being menaced by people in smiling masks.
Yeah,
set in London.
Looks like you live in a sort of pseudo utopian society where everyone's got to be happy all the time, and everyone else is either happy or wearing a mask that makes them look happy, but then they beat you up. Probably if you're not smiling enough.
Yeah, I don't know what else that game is about, really. But
it seems like a good jumping off point.
Good trailer as well.
Yeah,
good voice. Do we want to talk about Quantum Break, even though that's not a PC game?
Yeah, I mean, it's just about Remedy. We've got a good legacy of stuff on PC.
Mm-hmm. So they might bring it to PC, then.
They might well do, yeah. I mean, personally, I thought it looked really boring. But maybe I have no soul anymore. It was a third-person cover shooter where you got time manipulation elements. And a lot of games have tried this. And those include, like, kind of time domes where the time will slow down within those areas. And sometimes the entire action, the whole battlefield seems to freeze and fluctuate. And the visual looks amazing when that happens. Like the effects they're using for that stuff are spectacular.
And you then tell... you take cover, and yeah. Fire cover.
Fire your assault rifle over the cover at the armed guards who are firing their assault rifles at you.
So you use this beautiful, amazing kind of time grenade to freeze a guard, and then you just strafe around him and shoot him. And that, like, there's half an interesting idea there.
So those fights take place in a, like... time pause state where, like, everyone's paused except you and you're running around, and then the time cops show up and everyone's paused except you and the time cops. But also it looks like the time cops teleport at times.
Yeah, so you can.
And I wonder
if
that's not teleportation, but they are pausing time relative to you and moving while you're not looking. Because that would be hilarious if there's a third time scale which both of you have paused time relative to the rest of the world and they pause time relative to you.
Yeah, I don't know what the in-game excuse for that is. It does look cool, though. I like games which play time powers. Time Shift is actually an unexpectedly great... I retract that. It's an unexpectedly interesting shooter with interesting techniques that has obviously got a really botched and horrible development. It looks ugly as fuck. But all the stuff that they do in that game with kind of moment-to-moment time powers is really consistent, and they really, you know, go through with it. Whereas... what's the Singularity, the game by Raven, which also has time powers, only uses them in very specific context-sensitive places, and it feels like they just backed away from the idea because they knew they couldn't cope with the way it would break the game if they allowed you to play with time all over the place.
Yeah, it's not very satanic. Quantum Break looked to me like that won't be either, because it's so... They just portray these time powers as random, almost, like things just flicker in and out of existence, and sometimes you see the future and sometimes you don't, and sometimes this will time-lapse forwards and sometimes it won't. And it feels like that's... You establish early on that there aren't consistent rules to this, so that then you've got the excuse to do any kind of cutscene you want to do, like... Mm. Player walks into here, now we can show him this incredible vista or this weird flash forward that will give him some clues to the plot, and then we can never have to do that again.
Yeah. You know, non-specific accent, probably.
I enjoy, Remedy have always had kind of an interesting approach to like plots, and they often have a very good sense, interesting sense of humour, that I'd be excited to see how that is exercised through a kind of time travel like scenario. So yeah, that's why I'd be interested in that. Will it come to PC?
I tell you what is coming to PC and does have time slowing in it.
Oh, yes.
Cobalt!
Oh, yes.
Which is great.
Hooray, it is great.
Made by friends of ours, actually.
We played that. Mm. On PC Gamer.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Seemingly years ago, it feels like now.
Yeah, but it was kind of like the de facto office game for a while, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was really fun.
The trailer they released today was incredibly beautiful in a, like... sort of technical way. Like, it's just it's the game we've already played, and the sprites look really nice, and it's kind of a particularly well put together trailer. But also, just like the titles they put layer over it, and the way those kind of squish in and squish out again. And the whole thing is actually, I think YouTube might have improved their playback for 60fps stuff recently. You know, they've had 60fps for a while. But this is like, I think, the first trailer I ever watched where it was just. Like completely perfect, like I could have been playing the game on the best machine in the world and it would have looked like that.
There's been some Street Fighter V ones like that recently, just very recently, that have absolutely like so smooth.
It's funny, never would have said that I was annoyed at trailers dropping frames or things being slightly inconsistent or something, but they obviously work. As soon as you see it doing perfectly, it's like, well, holy shit.
Yeah, it's so much better.
This looks like the best thing in the world.
One of my favourite things about Cobalt is that you reflect projectiles, or certain projectiles at least, while you're rolling.
Yeah.
And the game goes into slow motion if you're in peril. And I think the slow motion scales to the number of people who are in peril in a given area. So if an explosion is going off and there are like five people near it, it will go almost stop. And so you get to precisely see who dies and how. And also it gives everyone the opportunity to roll and deflect things in really virtuous ways.
I tried to do something a bit like this in Heat Signature recently and it totally backfired, which is... when a ship launches a missile at you, I thought, okay, the smart way to do this is people getting destroyed immediately and didn't know why. So I thought, okay, time's going to go slow when they fire a missile at you, but it's going to go slower the closer the missile gets, because in my head that seemed really tense. Like, you know, they launch it at you from a while away, we don't slow down at all. As it gets closer, we start to go super slow-mo, and it's like Peggle with the ball going near the thing. If only this could be as cinematic as Peggle. But the problem is, if you smoothly ramp down time at the same rate that the missile is approaching you, then it seems like the missile is just staying still. And, like, all you notice is that you can't move as fast as you could before. So it felt like missiles were, like, ensnaring you. Every time a missile got closer, you felt just trapped.
That must be a trick of perspective, then, as much as anything, because Cobalt slows down, almost zooms in on areas of action where you can still see the rocket moving because you're really close, so that must give you the context.
Yeah, it's because stupid and I set my game in space where you have no frame of reference for anything, so if you're going at, you know, 300 miles an hour and it's going at 290 miles an hour, it feels like you're both static.
Yeah,
you should scrap that part of the game, just switch it to
put it on Earth. Put it in Cobalt's levels. You just sort of weave your way between the geometry.
Yeah, it does look good, and every time I meet those guys, I'm like, oh yeah, how's Cobalt going? And then they get this kind of distant, slightly pained look in their eyes. They admit the new massive feature that they've been adding for the last 6 months, like entire single player game. And you know,
really,
and
they do.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
We kind of played it like Nidhogg or Samurai Gun or sort of one of those local multiplayer games. We're playing online, but we're all in the same room and stuff. And it's a great, like, couch deathmatch game. But there is a whole single-player campaign, there's a co-op mode, there's all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. So have you guys been watching the International, the Dota International, which Chris is currently at, enjoying his birthday?
Yes. I started watching it when it started, just, like, to see the opening ceremony. And Gabe came on stage, and it's always, like, a little bit... exciting just to see Gabe in any context. He actually doesn't, like, he's not that visible, really. Like, the most he's probably said in the last few years publicly has been, like, a talk to an economics class in a university. And so it's quite rare to see him actually sort of come out and address the community. And he does so for about 40 seconds and just says, explains why the International is a highlight of the year for a lot of our people. And then he says, well, you don't want to listen to me talking, you want to watch some games of Dota, and then just leaves. And it's great. And you think, oh, that's the perfect way to start. And then it cuts to the announcers and they say, well, we've got a lot to get through. And they break down how they're going to talk about the International last year for like half an hour and then all this other stuff. So I kind of tuned out and I came back like an hour and a bit later and it still hadn't started. So I thought it had a massively overlong and stupid opening ceremony. But apparently I think they had technical difficulties, is that right?
I didn't notice any before the thing started, but that would explain why it took them so long to get going.
Yeah.
The first few matches seemed to be fine. But then during the second series, there was a break in one of the games that lasted almost an hour where the streams just seemed to go down completely. All the streams apart from the French stream and the French stream started playing Darude and wearing top hats.
Sandstorm.
And then they got a dog in and they became internet celebrities overnight because of the way they handled the Dota downtime.
I didn't know this.
That was by far, that's the only reason I kept watching.
So who was wearing hats?
Oh, this is the French streamers who are like streaming the International for French audiences.
Oh, okay, so they have like a separate casters booth or
something. They seemed like it looked like they were streaming out of their front room somewhere else entirely. But they definitely seemed to be part of the International coverage.
Right.
And I think the Russian stream was up and they were up. And obviously the game was paused because the players had stopped playing because they knew that all the streams had gone down.
Right.
And they seemed to be having LAN difficulties generally. The French guys, they stepped up.
During the hour-long delay, one of the presenters made a great tweet that was who is Phil and why do they want us to talk about him? It takes a second.
There was a lot of despair on Twitter because Valve didn't communicate very well what was going on, by which I mean at all, to anyone. So the stream would go up for a minute and then down again, and then it would go up for casters again, and then the players would left the booths at one point, and everyone in the arena was tweeting, they're leaving the booth, this is a disaster, and then everyone on the internet was just losing their shit, and the Twitch chat was just gone crazy, and they were rioting, and then like the players, obviously they'd just gone for a toilet break or something, they came back like 10 minutes later, and said, oh, the International is saved, it's fine, things are okay again, and then the match started, and everyone was just really excited to watch the Dota again, but it was a pretty big wobble for such a big tournament.
But what about the Dotes itself?
Oh,
because we our expert opinion with that.
This is great.
Chris here.
I watched the first. I'm not sure what terminology is. Like
it begins.
Game around.
Yes, that is what Dota is.
Three. What is a match and what is a game? Which one is the shorter one? It's the best of three.
In tennis terms.
What are the individual things called?
If we're going to use tennis terms, then a game is the smaller one and the match is the
smaller
one.
Okay, so I watched the first match of three games.
Okay.
And it was pretty good. I followed it most of the way through. And then afterwards I found out that was apparently, by itself, better than the entire International last year.
Oh, wow.
And also the best game of the day, which the day was 13 hours long in the end. And so I did the right thing. I'm probably watching that one and going to bed.
No, maybe I'll watch that. Just to say, Chris has prepared a massive cheat sheet for all of the kind of teams and everything you need to expect from the Dotes. So I might link that in the show notes, even though it'll probably be mostly over by the time.
Yeah, but that is essential because they don't give you any of that. If you're watching it, they don't give you like they do some little documentaries around the players and things, but they don't give you here is the current meta and here is why this hero is always banned and here is why this hero is super important now.
There is the noob stream, which is what I was watching.
Oh, yeah.
Where they do like an alternate commentary, and those are like that's official, that's people at the event itself. And
did you get a sense as to why that particular match was awesome then?
Yeah, I mean it had a lot of back and forth. It was a best of three that went to three matches, which is, I mean, I guess that's a spoiler if you haven't watched it yet. I assume anyone who's mega into Dota has probably watched at least that by now. And it had just some interesting games where like one team would take a really early lead and then just fuck it up, just like makes one massive mistake and then keep making a series of smaller mistakes after that and then really get to the point where, you know, the other team is going to crush them utterly. And that was quite interesting. And in two of the games, they you really got to see like the carry concept played out in a way that even I could understand. Like, they're always talking about the carry, and the carry is like the person on your team where you let them get all the experience and all the gold, and everyone else is just trying to get that person to level up. And I actually don't know which sense of the word carry it's named after, because you carry them, and then after a while they carry you, because they become so powerful that you just rely on them utterly. And in one of those games, one team had a guy with a big pike, I can't remember his name, Phantom Lancer, I think, who can clone himself, and he's like a really kind of tall guy with a really big weapon, and his animation is kind of interesting. This is the kind of thing I would look at when I'm watching a Dota match, is the animation of that character is interesting, because he doesn't attack that often, and when he does, it's a massive motion, but he does it incredibly quickly. So it has this really kind of weird, jerky, kind of awkward look to it. That I'm sure is probably a consequence of like the Warcraft 3 animation system or something, like somewhere back in the history. But when you have like 6 or 7 of copies of him all doing that thing, and he's, I think the game lasted 50 minutes, which is abnormally long. And obviously, if you have a character who's a carry and they're being leveled up all that time, then by 50 minutes they've just become a sort of complete god. Mm. And the commentators are just saying, oh, there's just no way to kill this person, no matter how much damage you put on them, they will just always survive it. And there's 7 of him. And seeing that surround like a tower, and they're all hitting it with their weird pikes, and they're all going in this weird jerky motion, and you see its health bar get completely crushed, it was quite a spectacle. And you did see like everyone pile on him, and he's like get injured, but just never really close to death. And that was kind of entertaining to watch, see like that it get to that situation where one person is that much more powerful than everyone else, because the rest of the time I just can't tell what the fuck is going on really. I see the effects, and I see, oh, that guy, I can't even really tell when someone's stunned, but I pretend to, right? He hasn't moved in a while, he's probably stunned. There was a great moment where someone got stuck in some trees. I think someone must have cast a spell on him which created trees, or it sounded like it was his own fault, like he'd done it to himself. And he got literally just physically stuck in the tree, so that he couldn't get out, and none of his teammates could get him out either. And he had to call his donkey to deliver him a teleport scroll. And it took like 2 minutes for this thing to, like, I don't even know if it was a donkey, but one of the couriers to trot all the way across the map to bring him a scroll so he could teleport out of the tree he was stuck in.
Yeah, the Phantom Lancer is great to watch, because his doppelgangers, when they attack enemy heroes, they drain their mana. So it's really cool in team fights, because you see them, like, they'll just sap the mana of them, like, one of the most dangerous enemy heroes, until they just don't have enough, you know, to cast any spells or anything. So there's loads of kind of aspects to that heroes that are really interesting. And once you start learning what they all do, you start recognising how fucking amazingly skillful the people involved are at doing them. There's a great hero. The first game was amazing because there were just some really exciting heroes in it. One of them is Storm Spirit, who is this kind of electrical god, who has this incredible mobility. You can just like become a lightning bolt and zip across the map, and he uses that to go like up into the enemy base if he wants to, or just up onto the high ground, anywhere he wants to go. It just seems like he can get there if he has the mana and he has the right items, and he also has this ability to kind of, when someone's getting away from him, he can kind of wheel them back. He like ropes them back with electricity, and he can also just zap the fuck out of them just to do loads of damage anyway. And watching that guy just zip around and kind of contain people and just be incredibly precise with his movements and who he's going for was really exciting. The other guy was Axe, who's this giant red dude with a big fucking axe, you'd be surprised to hear.
I think that's Chris's favourite character.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
He's amazing to watch because his special, his super move, is an enormous dunk, as they say in Dota parlance, which is just a massive amount of damage that just deletes you from the game. If someone's below a certain percentage of health and you hit them with Axe's special, it just fucking deletes them. It's like you're just gone from the game. And there are abilities, like there's one called Shallow Grave that's designed to keep you alive no matter how much damage you take. But because the rule of Axe is especially isn't that it doesn't damage, it just deletes them. If they're below a certain amount, it just goes through that. So you'll see people like, they're kept alive with the Shallow Grave, and then Axe will just come in and dunk. The best thing about it is that if you successfully dunk, the ability instantly recharges.
Oh, wow.
And it allows for these chain reactions, of which one happened where he just blinked into the enemy base up to where two guys were just below the kind of the portion of health that
dunk
he could
threshold.
Get away. And he just dunked one, dunked the other, and blinked out just in like under a second. It was insane to watch. And if you have no idea what's going on, then that's just, you wouldn't even notice it. That he just
yeah, I don't think I did.
Yeah, so two heroes just disappear off the map, and that's just Axe doing what Axe does when he's amazing. But it also just reminds me about, I could never play that game. I could never do anything.
You could never double dunk.
I could never double dunk. I could barely single dunk, I've discovered. These bots and rubbish. But I think that match was super exciting, and I love watching Dozer actually. The kind of ebb and flow of power and the back and forth between teams is really interesting and subtle. And there are ways for teams to come back if they've drafted the right type sort of heroes. So there's a hero called the Anti-Mage, which gets huge, but he like gets super huge maybe at the 17-minute mark, at the point where, to the extent that he just breaks the game, pretty much, as Tom was describing. But there are the heroes that kind of, they peak at different times in the match, and that's really, really interesting. That seems to just dominate the flow of play is when certain heroes peak, and if you kind of don't execute, if you don't like push for objectives while your heroes are at that peak, then you lose, which is what happened in the first game with Empire, where their heroes were peaking and they had this amazing chance to, they were just basically dominating the game, but they got really greedy and aggressive and just went right into the base and got picked off, and suddenly the massive swing happened, and that meant they couldn't attack for 10 minutes. By the 10 minutes time, 10 minutes were up, the other heroes were peaking on the enemy team, and by that time it was too late pretty much, because the carries had gotten too fat on the other side. And that ebb and flow of power is super interesting, and I've never seen a game that operates like that.
It's funny, I still can't really see that happen. I mean, I look at the net worth of players and the total kills and stuff, and that's the only thing I have to go on really, whereas in StarCraft 2, which I also don't play and also couldn't play to any degree of competence, I see things like that happen, like the sin of overcommitting and of pushing your luck and then getting punished and like super punished for it and losing the whole game on it. When I see that happen in StarCraft 2, I can kind of see it happening. Whereas in Dota, I hear the commenters saying it's happening. I'm like, okay, I'm sure that's happening. I see that the numbers are going up in that way.
It's not until the like team fights happen that you suddenly see that the carry does actually execute that power.
That's kind of what I was saying earlier, like the carry thing was nice for me because it was the one thing I could actually visually understand. Like, I see that the bright pink guy is not going away, he's still there. Other people, I don't know whether they came or went, but that guy's definitely still there.
I think as a spectacle it's great if you know enough about the game. I also love the stage they had, they've got at the International this year.
Oh yeah, they had like light effects showing the spell effects, right?
Yeah, they're in two opposing booths, and they're on a square platform that is the map of Dota, and the booths are positioned where the agents are positioned on the map, and whenever a spell goes off, the spell effect blasts across the map. It's projected on like from the ceiling, from one booth to the other. So if you see a sonic wave, the sonic wave will explode across the arena and attack them.
I feel like it's one step away from just projecting the game down onto the stage. So that the players could like just peer over their desk and say, oh look, he's over there.
That's fantastic. I think my biggest problem with it is that it's impossible to watch it if you have a job, because it's so long. It's so many games, and well, they go on and on.
Apparently, like the arena itself was emptying before the final match was over because of that big delay that they had, and just went really long to the night. People have been there for, Chris said, 13 hours, and surely people just left.
Surely they could whittle it down to a fewer than 16 teams.
I was thinking that. Like, it seems like it's too many for me to keep track of.
Previous years, it hasn't been that many, has it? Or has it?
I'm not sure. Right. I couldn't say.
I only really pay attention to who the teams are, like, at the final stages, because that's when there's few enough for me to understand. But yeah, there's probably an argument for that being the International, you know, when it's down to wait to make it the International.
I mean, they had the group stages, which lasted all week last week, and I caught as much as I could of those matches. And but basically, it was impossible to pass. The only reason I got anything out of it at all was because there were these brilliant daily Reddit posts on the Dota Reddit, which gave you a top 5 games to watch in order of excitement.
And yeah, it is ridiculous.
That's like, there's so much. And I only saw like a tiny fraction of the games, and it feels like kind of a shame because there's so much skill on display and there's so much exciting stuff to watch that there's just no way to physically watch it. And for that to carry, like I don't think so. The final stage is an entire week this week, so it's like, it goes on until Saturday. I'm pretty sure that wasn't the case in previous internationals. I'm pretty sure the final fling of it was over a short, smaller period. But I have to ask Chris. When he gives us his errata of corrections.
Yes. Special episode. Special hour and a half long episode.
But anyway, that's...
He'll be like, it's not your birthday now, shut up.
So those are my amateur...
Can I ask you a question about MOBA etiquette? I had a very strange game just before the podcast with Richard of HOTS. And it was one of these games where you get to pick heroes. It was in the Hero League version of it. So I was first pick, so I picked a tank character I particularly liked, and the second person to pick also picked a tank character. And then later in the match, we realised we didn't have nearly enough damage output. Which was predictable, because as soon as he picked that, both me and Rich went, why has he done that?
Mm.
And but he was complaining in chat about how we didn't have enough damage output. So Rich kind of politely just said, mate, you picked a tank second after a tank had already been picked.
Mm.
And he was like, no, I picked first. what do you do with that? How do you... Is there any point?
Is it conceivable?
It's possible he couldn't have seen it.
Picked at the same time, and it was like there was a massive lag or something.
Pretty clear. Like, my name is big and above his, and then his portrait, and he picked it like 20 seconds after I picked mine. Anyway,
does everyone see that stuff come through the same same order?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it's the same. But like, if somebody's just not on the same level of reality with you, how can you negotiate with them about tactics?
You have to call them a like a person's about their mother. You get a racial epithet in there, that'd be good.
Right, yeah.
I'm pretty sure you've hit on the central problem with it. One of the reasons I can't face going into Dota is that I'd love to play it in an organised context where I'm with my friends and we've all got roles and stuff. But that's impossible to organise online in a public environment. So the game doesn't really function, surely. It functions on some sort of level where you're just kind of going around on your own like sharks and trying to accidentally get a win, but it feels like you're not really playing the game.
I'm at the level now where I have good games and bad games, and sometimes they totally suck, but the thing that is always preventing me from winning is ultimately teamwork or lack of.
Yeah, I mean, this is my entire Team Fortress 2 career. I almost never played except in random public games, and it was frustrating sometimes. I think the way with that game, it's probably not as team dependent as like Dota, where if you're the dead weight on a team, you're actively destroying your team. But I tended to just like prefer smaller matches in the end. Like once I started to care about how well we did, I would just pick matches of like 3v3 or 5 or 6v6. And on that kind of team, if you're good, you can actually determine the outcome a little bit. You don't need everyone to be doing their job perfectly.
Games! What other games have you been playing, Tom? Francis?
I've still been playing Endless Legend, but like TF2, it is basically a different game depending on who you play as. Like, it's just there are like 5 races or 6 races, and that is 5 or 6 different games. And so last time we talked about it, I just played as the Peace Lizards, and I'd used the Peace Lizards to make peace with the only other race in the game, which was also the Peace Lizards. And I conquered all the territories around them, made peace with them, and then declared closed borders so they couldn't leave their own territory. And that worked, but then, as I said last time, like I was going for a diplomatic victory, but all you get, the only way to reach that is you just get a certain number of diplomacy points, and I got some for making peace and I got some for being in peace, and he was getting some diplomacy points for being in peace as well, but I was slightly ahead of him because I made the first move, and that was going to be okay. There was no other way for him to get more points than me, so it was just going to eventually win, but it was going to take like a year of real time. It was just absurdly slow. I was like 18% of the way there after 100 turns or something. I was like, that's just my life if I want that to happen. It's never going to happen. And so I ended up going for an economic victory, because it turns out the economic victory is a certain amount of money. You just got to make a certain amount of money. But brilliantly, it doesn't subtract the amount you spent. All you've got to do is earn that amount of money in total. All the money that's ever come into you in any form, even if you spent it right away, it still counts towards that total. And it's like 250,000 or something. But I realised, actually, that's one thing, unlike diplomacy points, where it will rise exponentially. The more money I get, the more money I can spend on things that make money. And because the spending of the money to make money doesn't count against your total, it's just rocketing. So I just ended up completely retooling my entire empire to a massive money-making machine and just hit that way before my diplomacy victory. So I won that on money. And then I was going to play as the roving clans next, which are the nomadic traders who get a cut of everyone's transactions on the open market and have a couple of other like commerce-related things. But because I just played as the Peace Lizards, when I got to the actual Empire selection screen, I was suddenly very tempted by the necrophages, who are the... They're like a cross between the Zerg and Nurgle.
Oh, right.
So, Zergle. They are insectoid aliens, but they also spread disease everywhere they go. And they, their only mission is just to destroy everyone. I think they can't ever make peace with anyone, and they can't even talk to the minor languages. Like, you can't do quests for them or anything like that, because you just can't speak to them in any way.
If only you can talk to the Zergal.
The description for that racial trait is you don't talk to your next meal. And so they just spread throughout the land, just consuming everyone. I think they... So anyway, their main hero is quite powerful in combat, and I just spread out really quickly, took loads of territories, and then focused on, like, making a good, like, death ball army, just having my hero and all my starting units and a couple of new units I produced in the same ball, and then attacking cities. And for most of the game, until the very late game, the most people you can have in an army is six. So I made an army of six units, and I attacked the nearest city, and just went straight for it, killed all the defenders, took the city, and you automatically capture it. You actually can't raise it, because you're not allowed to raise a city unless you have total control of it. And when you've just conquered an enemy city, it's kind of in rebellion automatically. Like, a certain percentage of those people don't really follow you, so you can't burn it down. And that didn't matter too much, but... Weirdly, after I conquered it, I took my army of six people out again, and they were eight people now. And I looked in the post-battle screen that says who died and who lived. None of my people died, because I had a really good army, and two people just were in my army now who weren't there before. And it turns out I had this unit called a proliferator, which I just got it because it's a ranged unit, and I like ranged units. But it turns out what it does is anyone it kills... after the battle becomes like a pustule zombie on your side. I think they're called the Battle Worn, and they're just like, yeah, tough melee zombies with hideous parasites all over them. And weirdly, they don't count against your army cap, or they do, but it won't stop them from being added to your army. So instead of being six out of six units, I was eight out of six. Huh. And then once I realized this, I was like, well, I should just, like, pick every fight I can, like, on my way to the next enemy city, attack everyone I possibly can, intercept, like, marauding monsters, attack enemy troops who are from factions I'm not even fighting at the moment. And so I did, and each time it would add, like, one or two extra units to my death ball.
Oh my god.
And ended up with, like, 27 out of 6. Well, this seems kind of unbeatable, because you can't join, like, that army of 6. You can have another army of 6, but they can't attack at the same time. You can't have them both in the same battle. And so no one else is necrophages, no one else can do this. And so I'm the only person who has a single unit that has this kind of strength, and obviously if you massively overpower your opponent, you don't really get any casualties. And I'm auto-resolving all of these battles, by the way, because it just takes... It does have a tactical battle mode, but it's absurdly slow. It just is going to take all of your day. And it's not... It's all right, but it's not... doesn't really add that much. If I was making this game, I would not have done a battle mode at all. I would have just had auto resolve. And it was going great, and I just attacked the nearest faction. I was playing on a 4-player map, because previously I'd only played on 1v1. And with the Peace Lizards, that caused a problem, because the only other faction turned out to be the Peace Lizards, and we wanted the same thing, so nothing really happened to that game. We just made peace, and then eventually I won. So I thought, okay, you've got to have more than one other opponent in a 4X game, otherwise loads of, like, diplomacy things don't really matter and all that stuff. But 4v4 on a small map instead of tiny, and on easy instead of newbie, turned out to be a bad combination. And that, actually, I don't think the AI difficulty is a problem at all, and I don't even think the map size... the map size was a problem. It just got to the point where I defeated one race really quickly, and then there were two others left, and the red and the orange. And I started attacking the red, and I destroyed their capital, and I destroyed a bunch of other territories, but they still had, like, four other territories. And the orange had about 8 or 10 territories. I had about 8 or 10 territories. And I could have just carried on attacking the red and eliminated every last one of their territories, but I was getting a bit bored of just conquering all their things. So I switched my attention to the orange faction and started attacking them. And... at some point, I destroyed the Red's capital, and it popped up a message saying, you are now one capital away from a supremacy victory, which means if you're the only race who still has your capital, you win automatically. Mm. And it doesn't matter who destroyed the other capitals, it doesn't matter why you have that, you could do nothing at all and just hang on to your capital. If everyone else loses theirs, then you win. And so it also popped up saying orange is one capital away from a supremacy victory. And what had happened is I destroyed one race outright, so I destroyed their capital, obviously. I destroyed the Reds' capital without really knowing it. And so now the Reds, I don't think they can ever... I wonder if... don't know what happens if they take it back, but they're never really going to take it back. I think it wouldn't count anyway. So it was like, okay, I'm actually close to victory. I can just find the Orange's capital, then I can destroy it. But also, if they destroy my capital now, I'm fucked. And the problem was I didn't know what their capital was. I'd scattered most of the map, but like, there's an icon next to your capital that tells you it's your capital, but you only see it when you're actually seeing the city, like when it's in your vision range now. So even though I discovered every city they ever had, I didn't notice which one was the capital. So I had no idea which one to go for. Yeah, there's no... I can't think of a good reason for it, because the capital can't change. I was trying to find it for ages, and then I got to a... I think they... I can't remember what they said to me, but the Orange faction made contact and had some... probably some treaty, like... I think they begged for peace. That was it. even though I wasn't really winning the war, they didn't like that they were in war and wanted to make peace with me. I'd pretty much destroyed the Reds by that point, and I was coming after them. And wanted peace, and they were willing to, like, pay for it. I don't know how it works. I guess I would have been allowed to do that. I wasn't going to do it. But even though my race can't offer peace, I think you can probably accept peace if someone else offers it. But in that trade screen, it showed me a list of all their cities, and it showed me which one was their capital. So then I knew the name of their capital, and I could go back to the map and find it. But also during that trade screen, I just thought, I wonder if... Like, the reason it pops up is because that's one of the things you can trade for when they're offering for peace.
No way.
Because it's such an extreme situation. Like, you might have your, you know, two towns left, and they've conquered the whole of the map, and at that stage, maybe peace would be worth giving them one of your towns. And so it's the only time you can actually offer a city in trade. And I just thought, I wonder if you'd give me your capital. Probably not. Like, in Galsiv, you can do this as well. You can give away planets and offer them in trade. But the AI just never goes for it. Like, no matter how much you offer, they'll never give you even their worst, shittiest planet. Not for all of your planets ever. Like, it's just 100% no. I don't even know why it's in the game. but in this case, so I was clicking on, okay, I want your capital. I only want your capital. You have all your other planets, territories, and I'm going to give you all of my money, all of my luxury resources, all of my strategic resources, a bunch of my units. I'm going to give you all these awesome war technologies, like, you know, not only good technologies, which they pay a lot for anyway, but also like military technologies, which usually no one ever trades. Give you all of those, and I'll give you some of my cities. I'll give you this city. And it shows you as you're offering these things what their disposition is, and it's 100% negative. I'll give you this city, 100% negative. I'll give you this city, 100% negative. I'll give you this city. And all my cities clicking them. And then I clicked on one of them, and it went to 100% positive. I'm like, what? You'll take this? This wins me the game. I won't say this to you, but really I'm thinking, this trade wins me the game instantaneously. And I know I'm offering you a lot, but you really think this is worth it? You think you're just going to give away your capital on this? And it wasn't my capital I had offered him.
Right, I was thinking that might be the punchline, but okay.
I'd kept my capital, and I was just about to click offer, and then I thought, shit, am I giving them their capital? Am I giving them the Reds' capital? Because I think you just have to own the other people's capitals to win this. So that'll be the one extra capital they need, and they would win the game.
Oh my god.
Fuck, they're playing on a higher level than me. A ball trade. No, we're going back to the old system where there's no peace and there's only war and I'm going to destroy you. And then I lost the war. And it was kind of miserable, actually. It was just reminding me why I don't play 4X games as much as I used to, because it just takes a fucking age. And that leads... I designed my strategy around that fact, because it's like, oh, I can't bother to crush all of the red towns, because it's just going to take fucking hours. So I move on to the orange, hoping I can go for a quick victory. And I couldn't, and dragging it out that long just whittled my death ball down to, like, 10 units or 12 units. And attacking a city is pretty much the only thing that could hurt it, because cities get not only defending units, but they have like a sort of defense bonus as well, so that's the only thing that can really hurt me. And I could have made other armies, I could have just built up my towns and defended each one meticulously, but it just would have taken so long. It would have been would have been my whole week, and yeah, so it kind of all fell apart in the end, and that's a bit sad.
don't whittle your death balls.
Never do that. Do you think it would? They could fix it. Like, how do you? Like, that's a perennial 4X strategy problem. How would you fix that? Do you want a fast forward mode, the way your troops auto deploy across the territory and you don't have to click everything on it?
Yeah, I think like ordering around individual troops is a pain in the ass. At that point, I had like 8 or 10 cities, and making sure they're all building something is a pain in the ass. There's no, you can like set a sort of, I think there's some kind of automated mode where you can set like, okay, you just run yourself. But the problem with that is Galsip has that too, and the issue is, it's not that I don't care what they build, it's that choosing what to build is not a fun decision. It's an important decision. It still matters, and it's worth doing it for if all you care about is winning. But if what you care about is having fun, it's not really worth doing it because it's just kind of boring. So setting for that governor mode, it's like, you know, you're costing yourself something here. You know you're messing up your empire by doing this, because the AI will make decisions that don't factor into your plans. And so I never do it. And I think the only way to get around it is, you can't make it an option that you know, you can let your things be automated. It's got to be either it is automated and you can't control it, or you control it completely, and controlling it completely is too slow. So I think you need, the thing I wanted to do, I kind of messed around with making a 4X game. I never really got very far with it, but I was going to have one army per city, and so that city's army is just always tied to that city forever, and all you do is like click on that city and then right click what you want to attack. And they would also have limited supplies, so there's only so far they can go before they have to return to their city to resupply, and that would be automatic. Like, if you send them further than that, they just won't go. And they, you know, returning them to the city wouldn't even be like, you wouldn't even have to tell them to go there. It would just be like either a single button on their control panel or whatever, or again automated. Once they start to run out of supplies, they would just automatically go back to the city. So you always know where they are. You don't have to position them correctly, and you'd only ever have like 5 or 6 total units, and they'd never be just kind of out there. You always end up in a situation where there's just like units just standing around in the territories, and it keeps asking you, what do you want to do with them? Like, I don't really care, just something, whatever.
Yeah. I wonder if there'd be any mileage in a game in which, you know, because all these games take aeons, and obviously you are some kind of omniscient ruler figure. Whether it would be better if you were embodied in some way, in order to survive this massive amount of time, you'd have to be readily, you know, regularly kind of podded and put into cryosleep, during which time the rest of the world would proceed in your absence, based on some kind of like high meta level instructions that your kind of deep freeze brain could communicate. But you'd have some kind of like very high level strategic decisions that you'd be able to make, but then you'd come out, obviously the world would have changed.
Yeah, that'd be good actually. That's all I want, really, is just some natural reason why I don't have control over this stuff for a while.
But I think it has to be baked into the game. I don't think it could be consensual in any way. Like, you could choose when to get in. Or maybe you could choose when to go in, but you'd have to go in based on how old you're getting in order to survive.
It'd be funny, you could do it like presidential terms, and you know, 4 years are going to be up soon. You don't know who's going to win the next election, so you've got to set up this empire to be almost undestroyable, and then some asshole wins the election, and you've got to sit back and watch him fuck it up for 4 years, then you get voted back in.
Back in your pod, Obama.
What have you folks been playing?
I've been playing N++.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a platformer which you play a little ninja guy in a minimalist world full of little yellow squares, and time is ticking down. Your yellow timer is always ticking down when you're in a level, and you snuffle up these yellow squares in order to recharge your ever decreasing timer, so you can stay alive. And all in the meantime, you're trying to get to the exit in each level, and there are mines everywhere, and there are enemies everywhere, and there's loads of shit that will kill you instantly, and you will die many, many times, and there are more than 2,500 levels.
Oh my god.
To navigate in
this
N++.
Game has been in development for 11 years, I believe, like if you count all of the N developments.
So is it the same game as N?
Yes, essentially it's the same game in terms of a lot of the movement systems, which are what the game is is entirely built on.
N being the freeware original on PC.
I believe it might have been in Flash Game way back.
Yeah, it was. People bitched. Well, it got a lot of flack for being a Flash game, but it was also like a downloadable Flash game. You couldn't play it in a browser. Someone once tried to make a browser version of it, but basically it was just it's quite demanding, and if you run it in a web browser, it just didn't run well at that point. And so, yeah, it was a Flash game you had to download. And they made N2.0, right? Not that long ago, I think, actually.
N2.0 or N Plus?
N Plus was the PSP version or something, or like a handheld version, and it was made by an external company.
Okay.
And then the PC version has been kind of their baby, and they've always updated it. And they've tried to do other projects, and they kind of aborted them all and come back to N. And yeah, the N Plus Plus has been something they've been working on for a long time as well. And that's meant to be the definitive version. And in fact, they even say in the trailer, no sequels ever. Because they're obviously fucking sick of this game. I would be.
It's fucking great, though. I can see why it took them so long. And to look at it, like, I think it's got a lot of derision from PlayStation 4 users because it looks so simple. On the outset, like, the screenshots don't really tell you what it feels like to play. And the thing that N has always had has been this very, very unusual sense of momentum, movement and weight that takes an enormous amount of mastering to actually, you know, to be good at the game. And what it's also brilliant at is the level design is superb in terms of you can hash it and just kind of be not that good at it, but just kind of get in there and get through the level. But you're always aware that there are more elegant ways through the level that you could have taken. And that always motivates you to go back and replay it. And given that there are 2,500 levels, like, it's basically all the platforming you could ever want.
Oh, they can't all be hand-designed. Are they hand-designed?
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, God.
They're hand-designed. They're definitely hand-designed. You can tell.
Why have they put this purgatory upon themselves? Just...
You can see the human hand in the way it's designed because there are ways that they tempt you to take more to riskier routes through the levels that are much harder, and it seems like an algorithm in the current generation couldn't generate that. It's clearly a thing that's been put there. And,
do you know if they're reused at all from previous versions? They've already had like 1,000 levels in
there. I think there are so-called legacy levels might be just repeats of the old.
Because that's levels. I'm not saying that to diminish their achievement because those levels they made, and that I was saying it because they absolutely should include those because the game's largely the same as I understand it.
It really is. The cool stuff they've added is this is a really, really good soundtrack, and there are many colour palettes that you can switch through that can change the look of the game, which is kind of cute.
It used to be that the whole game is on PC was blue-grey, and like dark blue-grey and light blue-grey, and those are the only two colours apart from the gold, and your ninja was black, and if you completed a chapter, which I think was 100 levels, you unlocked like a pink ninja, and it's the exact same sprite but it's coloured pink. And then you unlock the next one, it's like a yellow ninja.
There's definitely a lot of that stuff because a lot of the colour schemes are just question marks at the moment.
Right.
I think I'll have to, you know, just obtain obscene levels of competence with M Plus to actually unlock that stuff.
So there are two cool things, one of which has always been it's been an N for many, many years, is in the high score tables, if you're stuck on a level and you look at the high score table and you see this, like, you see the global rankings, you can click on those names to actually watch them play that level. You can see exactly how they did it. And I gather that's in the PlayStation version.
Oh, wow. I've not figured out how to do that, but I remember that being in the earlier versions, and that was totally awesome.
And the other thing is in N++, they have... a competitive mode. They also have a co-op mode, which I don't know anything about, but the competitive mode is you're all trying to get to the exit, and as far as I know, you can't hurt each other directly. Like, I think you're immaterial to each other. But they added a really great mechanic, which is ghost mines. And mines, like in single player, obviously you touch a mine, you blow up, and the mine blows up as well. And the fact that removes the mine from play is not significant in single player because you're dead and you're going to restart the level. But in multiplayer, of course, someone blowing up a mine and leaving it empty gives the next person an advantage to get past. But all destroyed mines become ghost mines, and if you walk through a ghost mine, it doesn't hurt you, but it creates the mine for the next person. So it makes it respawn. So there's this, every mine is constantly being toggled on and off by you. And so you'll, like, someone's cleared the mine, and that's great. And so instead of avoiding it, you actually intentionally walk through it in order to set it up for the next guy. But then if you die, you've got to get past it now.
A lot of the levels are really cleverly designed around those toggling mines, even the single player, so that you jump in certain ways to allow yourself a route back.
Right.
To leave yourself a route back. If you were to just, like, walk along all the floor, which is in completely ghost mines, then you would leave yourself a carpet of mines to walk back. So it's about jumping in a certain pattern to give yourself a pattern back, and that becomes ever more intricate the more you go, the more you go forward in the harder levels. It's fucking ridiculous is how good it is. I love it. There are also these brilliant mines where you pass them, and then they're just a disparate cloud of pixels that then slowly coalesce and become a ghost version of yourself, and then tracks where you've jumped in the level, and you have to avoid them because if you touch them,
oh my god! Yeah.
So there are these levels where you're again jumping across a jumping puzzle from left to right, and you'll trigger a couple of these guys, and they'll start doing your motions. But when you actually have to travel from right to left, and then avoid yourselves coming at you,
yeah.
Like it's just so simple but so brilliant. It's a really good challenge.
I hate my past self.
Do you play Shuggy?
No.
Kind of you wouldn't necessarily think to play it because it has a bit of a kind of chirpy cartoon aesthetic, which you wouldn't necessarily associate with high class hardcore platformer game, but it involves time mechanics, and you've got to trigger past versions of yourselves to do certain things in the level in order to complete the things, but you also need to avoid yourself as well, and it's a fucking nightmare.
Yeah.
I realise that there's a certain point at which my brain cannot cope with multiple timelines. I top out at a kind of disappointingly low level there intellectually.
I'm really glad N++ is good. I hope it does well, because I've known those guys for a long time.
Yeah, they deserve to be free of that
problem. N was an absolute favourite game of mine at the time. I think my taste kind of changed at some point, and I was less into hardcore platformers after that.
Yeah.
But it's the only hardcore platformer I've ever really loved. It's great that it finally came to fruition, because they've had a long and frustrating journey to that.
Yeah.
There's one thing I wanted to ask about N++, because towards when I started to eventually sort of have my fill of N, I played a lot of it, and at some point I started to like it less, partly due to just the novelty wearing off, but there was also this, like, certain things I was dying to, I started to blame the game for. And it's not really... It is very a very consistent game. It is fair, but it's just sort of unrealistic, maybe? Or basically, so the problem, specific example of it I'm thinking of is there were a level I got really pissed off with was one where all of the platforms are just little discs, little circles, and the way it handled curved surfaces was slightly annoying, because you would, at a certain speed, you would slide down them smoothly, and at a slightly higher speed, you would sort of slide down most of them but come off them occasionally and then land on them again. So for like a brief second, you're in the air, not on the platform, depending on kind of your current velocity. And that difference is very slight visually, but absolutely critical mechanically, because if you're in the air, you can't press jump. And if you're on the ground, you can. Mm. And so I was just dying all the time to like, oh, I thought I was on the ground there, but I actually wasn't. Or I, like, maybe it's visually clear that I wasn't on the ground, but before I moved, I didn't know that I was moving fast enough that I wouldn't count as being on the surface. And there was something about the way I handled curved surfaces that I started to find really fiddly and annoying.
Has always had, and still has, a very unusual interpretation of how momentum works and how hitting angled surfaces can actually almost increase your momentum, which is very, very unusual and takes a lot of getting used to. And that stuff can be very fiddly. And I think when that's adapted to curved surfaces, maybe it becomes that much harder. I can only think of one puzzle where I've had that kind of frustration with curved surfaces, where there's a level with a circular thing in the middle, which is rotating with a laser on it that will instantly kill you. But there are four ways in, and then a kind of atrium in which this thing is rotating. And it's a brilliant level because you can just go right down underneath it via a separate passageway and navigate a load of mines to get around it. But there's like a super pro way where you just dive in towards this circular laser while it's pointed downwards, and then bounce off it and up through the chute, which is, as soon as I saw that was an opportunity, I just had to fucking replay it over and over and over and over and over again until I nailed it, which is why I love N+, because it gives you those options. You don't have to kill yourself doing that.
Yeah.
And the instant restart, really, totally instantaneous restart really allows that. But about getting the angle to bounce off that ball in just the way that I could then just shimmy up a passageway was difficult and inconsistent, but I think it was just that I wasn't good enough, because it's a game about trajectories as much as anything, about angling the trajectory of your dude as they're like sailing through the air in these really odd arcing patterns. And I think it's probably a thing you just have to get really good at in order to like it and obsess with it.
There is, I believe it, Impulse Plus has a level designer built in and level sharing and stuff.
It does,
and,
yeah.
And that's also true in the PC version. And there is an amazing community that I covered at PC Gamer sometimes called the DDA levels. And it stands for Don't Do Anything. And they make levels where you literally don't press any keys, and the ninja just starts in a position where they're going to fall down, and when they hit the ground they're going to hit the slope, and that slope will push them into this jump pad, which then launches them into the air, another jump pad, they'll go past 9 enemies and then hit something else, and as long as you don't touch anything it will all work out perfectly, and the ninja will go through the entire level and complete it whilst like going through incredible narrow escapes and just causing cascading chain reactions and spectacular things. But it's not like a movie, because it is technically you are playing the game, and if you touch any kind of key at any kind of time, you will break it. You'll instantly die, because every other situation is death. And so it was just art, basically. People just making, here's a really amazing thing to watch.
That's fucking awesome.
Apparently that's already happening with M++ as well.
Ah, so good. Yeah, I really hope they bring it to PC, and I think they might, unless they're so sick of it.
I'd always assumed it was going to be on PC and PS4 simultaneously, and I hadn't really registered that it was PS4 only, and I did register that a while back. But yeah, it doesn't seem like they would port it to PC exactly, because they would be sick of it, right?
Yeah. Maybe it's not that hard a job, but he says.
I saw just today somebody telling them, oh, I'd love to see it on PS Vita, and they said, oh, if it does well enough, we'll port it. So maybe that's the case with PC
as well. Yeah, they said that to us as well. Marsh.
Hi.
What have you been playing, man?
I've been playing two things. I've been playing Life is Strange Episode 4, which I will only say this about, which is that it's one of the most uneven game series I think I've played. Mm. But it's kind of still great, I think. But this episode, I mean, fucking livid. It's screaming with anger in the quiet of my empty house.
Seen people on Twitter going, whoa, shit just got real.
I have to play the whole series, because the reaction on Twitter has been amazing to watch. Like, every episode has had, like, whoa, I can't believe the thing in Life is Strange. Yeah. And episode 4, more than any, has just been like...
What's weird is that everything that's... I won't spoil anything, obviously, but the things that people seem to be amazed about are so obviously set up in the previous episode that I was totally expecting that. I know our friend Kim played it and was annoyed at this decision... or the setup or whatever scenario being presented to you, because she thought it was emotionally manipulative. But I kind of got beyond that, because I knew it was going to happen. Anyway, that's all fine. But there's just like, what's so uneven about it is that they have like different teams working on alternate episodes in order to ship them in time, but like one team just doesn't understand how any of their systems work, it seems. So like at the basic level, you've got like dialogue trees and stuff. And there's kind of conversational challenges where you need to convince a person of a thing, and the entire premise of the game is that you have time manipulation power, so you can reverse any decision you have and go back in time. But the way this works in this particular, in so many of the conversations in this, is that the conversations aren't challenging themselves. As a sensible human being, you would pick the right decisions. Were they properly explained to you? But the dialogue options are given to you in such vague terminology that you have no fucking clue what it means.
It's the LA Noir problem. It's the doubt lie thing problem.
Yes, it's exactly that. It's so annoying. Like, but I'm so much more invested in it than I was in LA Noir for some reason, because I really like the characters, and a lot of the dialogue is actually really well written. It's just that nobody has subbed. They haven't got Tony Ellis, the heroic sub of PC Gamer, to go through this and say, this doesn't mean anything, you fucking idiot.
So it's a difference between like the text presented on screen and then what she actually says when you select it.
Yeah, but it's like you'll be given 4 different options. It's really critical you get this right, otherwise you have to replay the entire conversation. This might take 5-7 minutes, something like that, like a substantial period of time. And you'll pick something that seems completely innocuous, like even completely misleading. You're talking to a guy about his dogs, like, and one of the options is something like fighting dogs. And I know that this guy has rescued dogs who have been previously fighting dogs. So I think, well, you know, I'm going to buster him up. I talked to him about how fighting dogs. And instead, she accuses him of using dogs for fighting. I'm like, you fucking idiot. Yeah. That's not... And then, after that, you're locked into a series of conversational things that you cannot escape, and you cannot rewind until you get to the end of the conversation. It's just like, why is that? How do you know? You've played your own game. You've got three episodes already to look back on to say, I understand it. Anyway, that's really annoying.
That is super annoying. And I look forward to experiencing that. Like, however, it's horrible. Like, because the guy you play is a total asshole. He actually plays two characters in the end, and like the second one is fucking brilliant. And the first one you play for a lot of it is a total asshole. But remember,
yeah, he is, isn't he?
There are like three options when you're interrogating someone, or just questioning someone on the street, not even interrogating them, which is like truth, doubt, or lie. And that's...
means completely different things in each conversation.
Just the... and also there's just the grammar of that. Like, truth. Am I accusing you of being true? Or, like, am I demanding the truth? Or
am I telling the truth?
Am I telling what the fuck does doubt mean? So I remember, like, there's this lovely old lady who'd been traumatised by something. And, you know, she says something. And then I press doubt. It's like, thinking, I'm not sure that's entirely true. And then Cole Phelps just goes... what are you hiding from me, you whore? Or something like that. And I was like, whoa.
She starts urinating on her.
Yeah, so really, she really starts crying. Totally strange. And it's like, oh, I've got all F for the game now. Go have a shower. I can understand that is a horrible frustration, because it seems like such a basic problem to fix, right?
Yeah.
The rest of the game is there.
Just read it through.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that's annoying about that episode is that probably the stupidest decision that you'll make in the entire series occurs without you having any consent over it. And it's like, no, wait, well, what are you doing? Don't do that. That's really, really, don't, please. Don't. Oh, okay, I see. It has that serious repercussion that I completely expected. Well done. And the other game I've been playing, which is also kind of a disaster, is Zombie Playground, which is interesting, not because it's a good game at all yet, though it could be maybe at some point. You may remember like a piece of concept art from 2012, which was doing... it got on Kotaku and all these places. It was a picture of like four kids on top of like a helter-skelter in a playground.
Yeah.
It's really beautifully rendered. There's one, I think he's got a dustbin lid, and they're fighting off these little baby, you know, kid zombies... it's by Justin Chan, who's an amazing concept artist who works, I think, for Massive Black, which is like this conglomerate of amazing concept artists that does bespoke work for film and games as and when they're needed. It captured the imagination of the internet. You know, it shared a lot. Do you remember this at all?
No, I don't remember this particular
one. I reckon
you'll remember the picture if you see it.
Okay.
Because it did. It was kind of like all over the place for weeks. But then, obviously, it did. It made enough kind of impact that somebody said, "Oh, maybe we should try and make a game out of this." You know, on Kickstarter, we can kickstart a game. And so, Massive Black, a conglomerate of concept artists. Not game designers, but concept artists, decided to kickstart a game project based on this, where you would play as a kid fighting other kid zombies in a school, as it turns out. And they asked for a modest sum of money, $100,000, I think, which is obviously not nearly enough to make any kind of game. And they got it, and they got $160,000-something, I think, which is still not nearly enough to make any kind of game. And then for many years they didn't really produce a great deal. They had some kind of 3D level wireframes. I think they produced some kind of alpha which you could walk around this environment. But basically things were static for fucking ages. And then a while ago, I think maybe last year or the year before, there was a big kerfuffle, and they seemed to pass on the IP to a separate company, which Massive Black had spun off in order to make it, supposedly spun off. I don't really know the details about how many of the exact people who were working on it originally are now working on it. There seem to be another two companies that are involved in it as well, who are doing little bits. I don't know, but the thing is, it's impossible to tell what the size of the team is that's involved in this. I pity, like... I was mean about it on RPS because it's not very good and it's been a long time coming, and I've obviously people who've paid money for this who are upset about a lack of fulfilment on those promises. But I feel bad for the people who are now in charge of making this game, because they may be well talented. I don't know what their kind of resources at their disposal. Probably not a lot now after so many years.
Yeah.
And you know, I imagine what they're trying to aim for is like a basic fulfilment of the Kickstarter promises to kind of avoid being horribly sued. I don't really know, but all that they have achieved so far in this time is to have like this school environment, which is only partly explorable. It's very low poly, and I guess it's made in Unity. It's kind of lit in an underwhelming way. There's no dynamic shadows. It just kind of looks. But I know that sounds like a kind of biscuity thing to say about a game, but only kidding, John. But it's kind of important in this case, because that game was sold on the imagination of that particular image. You know, the fidelity that that image presented you with was the game that you were picturing in your head. And you know, they said it was going to be like a brawler, but also an RPG and all these other things. They've got an XP system in the game. Doesn't really. There's no point to it. You can just level up, and then you can play the level again. You level up more. You play the level again. You have different objectives within that level. They're both all rubbish so far. Like just kill more zombies. You know, well, I don't really want to. And that's it. And it's just there's a combat system in there which is reasonably interesting. There's like a time-based attack system, so that you strike, your weapon glows. If you strike again, when it glows, then you get a different kind of combo, and it's a different combo depending on whether you strike once or twice and then three times and then wait. And that's actually interesting. You get kind of mobility, but it hasn't been matched with any of the kind of other things that exist in the game. So constantly enemies just respawn. They respawn right out of the ground, right next to you, all the time, forever. And that doesn't, so all the mobility options that you have a kind of moot, because you'd just be moving out of the way and into another group of enemies, one thing. And if you wait for any amount of time, you're just leaving yourself open to be attacked, whereas you could just stagger people by just thrashing forever the same button. And none of the, you know, all the, that's fine. Like, I mean, you know, it's in early access. They're saying this is not a finished game by any means, but it's not a finished game by any means. Like, it's not even the game that you had pitched to Kickstarter yet as a game. And I don't know, it just feels like the cautionary tales of Kickstarter are coming to home to roost in a big fucking way.
Yeah, we all said this was coming.
Like, yeah, I know.
A few years ago, we literally had these conversations about, probably on this podcast a lot of the time, years ago, about, okay, in a few years' time, we'll see the big successes of failures of Kickstarter. Mm. And what it has transpired has happened is that there are successes and failures, but also people who are locked into eternal fucking horrible purgatory trying to fulfil promises that they could never actually reach. And
I feel worse for the developers than I do for the people who backed it, probably who backed it with, you know, an amount of money that was relatively inconsequential to them, I hope, on the most part. Like, maybe some people put down a huge amount of money, I don't know, but like, for the most part, you can imagine people doing the kind of minimum Kickstarter reward, put down the money for it.
Yeah.
And I don't think those people are going to be as punished by the development cycle of this game as the developers themselves. I feel really bad for them, and I really hope that after 6 months, which is what they anticipate staying in early access for, they do come out with something worthwhile playing. I think it's not impossible. I don't think it's ever going to live up to the imagination of the people who went for that Kickstarter in the first place, but you know, it's a brutal thing to witness.
Yeah, it's pretty grim. It's pretty grim. I've always had a problem with the way that Kickstarter has probably accidentally presented what it is you're investing in that a lot of people, I think, who contribute to Kickstarter think they're going to get the dream in their head, and there's not really perhaps enough messaging about the fact that a lot of projects fail and a lot of projects will change and become very different. And the realities of game development are incredibly difficult, and things can change course and have to change course in order to become a good game, instead of trying to go, you know, become the original idea for the game that it wasn't very good.
Yeah, well, which was just a piece of
concept art. Indeed just a piece of fucking flat concept art.
And I don't know. I'm going to kickstart a noose, and then as a stretch goal, I'm going to have a chair. another stretch guy, I'm going to stand on that chair and put the loose up, mate.
It's grim. It's grim.
Stretch goals are particularly mad, I think. But you don't know enough to make that call right now. You can't make that call right now. It's a really bad idea. It's outright detrimental to the game.
Talk about like feature creep being a problem of like game planning, but enforced feature creep due to monetary
enslavement
to a load of people. Like that's
and also it's just worse. It's such a fiction that if we get the minimum amount, then we'll have money left over. We'll just have this big pile of money. What will we do with it? How will we ever spend this? No, you'll burn through what you ask for and twice what you ask for, making the basic bare minimum that you promised.
Well, the amount they asked for wouldn't even pay for a single programmer to work for, 2 years?
I mean, maybe it's more disturbing if they can pull it off, because then it's how much do you pay?
Yeah. I mean, Tommy managed it really well, but then you put a lot of your own free time into it, programming and building it.
Well, for Gunpoint, it was all revenue share, so everyone worked for revenue share. Mm. So none of us paid anything as we worked on it, and then only after it came out did we make money. Mm. And then, because it did well, we did well. But if it had bombed, we all would have been totally cheated of our time. But, I mean, we were just completely upfront about that, and I never suggested to anyone who worked on it that it was going to be successful. I always said we have no idea. Mm. In fact, everyone who worked on Gunpoint, when they signed on, I hadn't decided yet whether to charge for it, so they signed on knowing that it might just be free and they might have zero money.
Yeah, sure. And, all of the investment there is the people making the thing, and the investment is time. As soon as it becomes a question of strangers investing in your thing with false ideas of what it might become, that just opens up so many problems.
Very scary.
Yeah, it's terrifying. Oh well.
Shall we do some questions?
We shall do some questions. Thank you as always for your questions. The first one today from Henry Stenhouse: best gaming soundtracks to buy? Possibly for gym use.
I think we've probably answered this before in some ways, but a new one popped up today, particularly for gym based kind of activities, which is the Myriad soundtrack. Myriad being, I don't think you'd actually buy it as a soundtrack yet, so obviously it's a shit answer, but it will be presumably available to buy. Myriad being, I don't even know what kind of game it is, some kind of music based score attack game. Doesn't look exactly like a shooter. It looks fucking mental. You should definitely look at the videos.
Yes, I know.
Played by Erlen Grefsrud.
Oh yeah, I know that guy.
Or Grefsrud, who is Slactus on the Twitters, and the game looks psychedelic and crazy in some kind of abstract way, which I can't quite parse exactly how it operates. Mm. But it has this amazing fucking soundtrack by, I've written this down, Matthias Rudsengen, otherwise known as Fastland, on SoundCloud, and his tracks are amazing, and they're great, and they're really kind of upbeat and exciting, and they're the perfect kind of gym music, I imagine.
I recently watched the Summer Games Done Quick thing we talked about last time. I watched the Hotline Miami 2 speedrun they did today.
Oh, yeah.
Fucking amazing stuff.
Although that's more kind of like murdering people in an alley music with a hammer.
Definitely.
Than,
if you're going to do that, cue this up. But what was conspicuous about it was I knew I was never going to play it, so I wanted to watch the speedrun just to find out what was in it. And that's literally the quickest way to do it. There's no quicker way to find out what's in the game than watching a speedrun. And it was interesting because they have very strong opinions about it. You'd think like speedrunners would be in some ways, you think they'd be the massive fans of it because they're playing it obsessively. But they are just as critical of Hotline Miami 2's levels as a reviewer would be. This one's just garbage. It's just throw some bullshit at you, and they'll bitch about all these different ways things work. They agree with Chris Thurston that dogs are broken. But the other thing they say is every time a level starts, almost every single level, they say, this one's it's got a really good pace to it, I really like this level, and the music is just one of the best tracks in the game. And the next level they say, this one's quite tough, but it's really long and actually quite satisfying, and the music is one of the best tracks. It's such good music.
Yeah, those guys do pick a good soundtrack, as we said. Although that's all kind of fucking nightmarish, horrible, psychedelic synth of the kind of most horrendous kind. Like, it's wonderful, great music, but it also is the music of having a bad trip while being covered in blood, somebody else's blood.
It's fun to program to this. It's like, it sort of adds a time pressure that doesn't normally exist.
I think it, so if you're on a treadmill and you want to go to a really dark place, then put on the Hotline Miami 2 soundtrack, which was actually going to be my suggestion as well, because it matches itself brilliantly to writing and stuff.
Can you buy it separately? Is it?
I'm sure you can.
DLC for the main game, or
it's definitely included as a separate thing if you buy certain editions of the game.
The way I've listened to it is just for convenience on Spotify. There is a playlist called that, made by an unofficial user who has collated all the tracks that are on Spotify that appear on that.
I'm pretty sure it's just OGG files with the game itself, so you can probably just play it.
All over YouTube as well, if you wanted to give it a casual listen, that download even thing. Tom Sabatino writes, "Dear CNC, am I a shit person?" From one Tom to another. The diss is big, so cruel. I know developers spend years putting their heart and soul into some games, but I dismiss most of them after only a couple of hours. Some I know are cult classics and have Steam users logging thousands of hours. The most dedicated of these users even found a way to bend space and time just so they could put 250 plus hours a week into their favourite title. While I've played through my Mass Effects multiple times and Spelunky Daily a Day keeps the Doctor away, for the most part, I just browse the surface level of the game, and once I, quotes, figure it out, I usually toss it, move on to the next thing I bought on the cheap. My question, how long do you give a game to wow you before moving on? Cheers, Tom. P.S., he writes, I have played through Gunpoint twice.
Oh, what a shit person.
Don't you feel bad now, Tom? Don't you feel bad now?
I was going to say, actually, that he seems to feel bad that he hasn't massively played games that other people are massively playing.
Mm.
And I think you shouldn't feel bad about that at all, because, like, from a developer's perspective, there are people out there who fucking love your game and they're playing for thousands of hours. You don't give a shit that there are some people who don't. Like, you're not like, oh, but that one guy, he only played for an hour. What's wrong with him? We hate him. He's a shit person. You get that some games are for some people and they're not necessarily for everyone. And definitely, like, if you give the game a chance, then you've done all you're obliged to do, for sure.
I guess the question is, like, how much of a chance do you give a game? What is it that really switches you off a game?
I came to think about this a lot with puzzle games, because I played a lot of puzzle games where I would just have a really specific moment of fuck this. Just call it the fuck this point. And it's quite easy to identify why it happens when it happens, because it's almost always tied to the first time they introduce death. If it's a difficult game, like you go through the first two or three tutorial levels and they teach you this mechanic, that mechanic, and that mechanic, and on this one, if you fall in the lava, you reset the whole level. And if that doesn't piss me off enough to quit, it'll be the first level that has actual challenge and that in. Like, as soon as you combine challenge and losing progress, that's when I'm usually out, if I'm not absolutely loving it. And so if you're a game designer, you should think about delaying that moment for as long as possible until you've really, certainly don't put that moment before you've explained the full potential of what it is you're trying to do with the game. Like, if you have some cool mechanic that has some interesting consequences, introduce the interesting consequences before you introduce the punishing repetitive failure.
Mm-hmm. I think for me it's when there's an element that is outside of my control that kills me and loses progress.
Yeah.
In any context, it could be a puzzle game or a combat game. An instant kill mechanic that takes me out when I feel it hasn't been, like, maybe the system hasn't been properly explained, or it feels as though there's some kind of, I don't know, it feels like the environment is conspired against me in a way that I was never able to, would never have been able to overcome.
Yeah.
The thing is, there's so many things you can do with your time nowadays. Like, I think my cruising altitude is something like a nanometer above the fuck this point. Batman Arkham Knight fell victim to this, because I went because Chris is away, so I thought, finally I get to use his PS4 actually, and play Batman. And there is, I couldn't read any of the button prompts because they're too small, and they're on a screen which is several meters away from me, and introduces almost instantly quite a complex, from what I can tell by the blurred pixels that are some distance away from me, complex button point for dealing with people who are charging at you, and it gives you maybe a second to read that. Like, I will need to stand up, move 2 meters closer to you, bend down and read that for a good second before I can parse what that says. And that combined with like some really totally dog shit fucking cinematics at the beginning of that game, and then a tank section, like maybe 6 minutes into the game, I was like, yeah, I'm just going to wait for this to come out on PC.
The people charging towards you, I had that sort of problem as well. I could read the prompt fine. Well, in theory, I could read it fine, but it was always in the middle of combat when I'm dealing with 9 other things.
Yeah.
And there was something, eventually it was like left trigger or something, or left button, and I always get those two confused, or like it was L1 or L2, and I didn't know which one was L1 or
L2. You have to double tap L2.
Thing. And the other thing is, even once I knew the button was, I thought it was saying, I didn't know, it doesn't say what it does, it just says the person charging you press that. And I thought it meant like that was the counter, so when they reach you, you should press it.
Mm.
But actually, if you wait for them to reach you, it'll never work. You always have to press it before they reach you. Whereas every other counter, you have to press when they do it.
Oh, right.
And it's actually what it will do when you press it is you throw a batarang at them and then they get knocked over by that. And so it's a way of stopping them from getting to you in the first place. But for ages, I thought it was a way of countering them once they got to you. So for ages, it just never, ever worked.
Yeah, we were talking in a previous podcast about tilt and how Batman puts people on tilt in ways that other games don't. And like the first, the tutorial section, which basically lasts until the end of Ace Chemicals, is full of just bullshit bits that... so, you know, we've spoken before about the hostage situation inside a building, where they then expect you to train outside with yes. augmented reality sections. Like, when there's a life-threatening hostage situation happening, like, 10 metres away. There's a load of very strange stuff in that game. It's definitely... There's a lot of points in that game where I would alter for if I didn't like Batman so much.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely going to go back to it, because, obviously, I've seen Chris playing bits which look great.
Yeah.
And I want to play those bits. It's just... it wasn't enough for me to tolerate. Like, I was just thinking, yeah, I could watch that interesting film I just saw on Amazon Prime.
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
Once you get out of Ace Chemicals, that's where the game like properly gets good. Mm. Really good, really starts. Next question from Zach. Dear Mr. Video Games. I was in some woods the other day. I couldn't think of a game that had captured the claustrophobic excitement of a wood. In a proper forest, thanks to the topography of rum and photos. Yeah, you could barely see 20 feet in any direction. This makes the world an odd glimpse of the sun, a deer, or a luridly coloured condom all the more thrilling. So, have any games done a good wood? Kind regards, Zach Forrest.
Have they done a good wood where you could see a condom?
No condom, but excellent wood in The Vanishing of Ethan Carter, which used the special technique for scanning textures from photographs onto the surfaces in the game, and has excellent bark as a result.
good bark. Yeah.
Top bark.
I need someone to confirm this, to make sure I'm not going mad. Did you see the flashing lights in Ethan Carter? In the trees?
Well, there's
no one saw this except me.
Yeah, there's stuff, weird stuff that happens in the woods.
Like, I don't mean like a special scripted event or something, but just all the way out the game. I would often be like just wandering around the open world and wondering where to go next.
Right.
And there would be a flashing light in the trees that's either white or red. And the way I deduced it worked was that red meant I hadn't been there and white meant I had, or vice versa. And very rarely there'd be a blue light. But this was throughout the whole game, and like every 5 minutes I would see one of these things just flashing.
Was the game
in the
telling you to kill people?
No one else has seen this. I'm really worrying about it.
No, I never experienced that.
I've only played the first half hour of the game.
Game. I didn't see any of that.
The whole thing constantly happened.
Oh my god.
No.
Listeners, please write in if you have experienced this.
Hero Brian, I think your game is
haunted. It was really useful. It told me, like, oh, I need to go this way next.
Patrick writes, Dear Quentin Grobar, I've written in before to ask about music, games, and the mental association between the two when randomly juxtaposed. Pogsing my way through Transport Tycoon as a youth left a permanent bond between the two, for example. I now turn to that most primal of all memories, smell. I remember my first smell. I don't. Is that a primal memory? Anyway, do you associate any games with smells? Do you think some games should support smell if it becomes available? And which games would you most like to take a good whiff of? Thanks for sniffing, everybody. Patrick.
I have a very, very strong association between the smell of teasels and...
What's a teasel?
It's like a big dry thistle.
Oh yeah.
Okay. So you've probably seen them, like a big, like the, almost the size of that microphone right before you.
As you can see, podcast listeners.
But shaped out of vegetation instead of, and it's dry and it's kind of spiky.
Mm.
But anyway, between that and the Super Mario Brothers 2, and also that memory is connected with riding a bike for the first time. And all those things
why?
Why?
Together. Because I learned to ride a bike while I was playing Mario 2 in a room full of teasels. It's not. It's really not that. It's not that.
How the hell did those things happen?
I'm doing the maths here. I'm doing the maths, but the logistics are...
You rode a bike indoors?
No, that just happened at the same kind of time in my life.
Okay. Yes. I'm trying to figure this one place
riding a bike while playing Super Mario Bros. 2 with a teasel stuffed in my nose.
I don't think... I just play all the games in the same place, so the smell is always the same. The stench of my own life rotting. Whereas the music is very different each time.
Did you not play games as a kid and have an association of that smell with those games? No?
We used to... My first computer was a BBC Micro, and that was in one room of the house, and then later on my dad got a PC, and that was in a different room of the house, and then I got a PC, and that was in my bedroom. So in theory, those must have all been different environments, but I don't remember any smells from them.
Huh. What games would you like the smell to?
Definitely Oblivion, or Skyrim.
It would mostly like smell as shit,
forest,
like forest, the entire of the medieval.
Forests smell really good in general. Yeah. And snow actually has a really nice smell.
I'd pick one of the MMA games.
What, just the smell of sweat and,
yeah,
and
just,
blood?
Yeah, get right in their crotch.
Oh, that's a good idea. Yeah.
Just it.
Get right in their crotch is a good idea.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't want that really.
Mm. That's what you claim. anyway.
Cooked Serve Delicious, Graham's favourite.
Oh, yeah. It'd
probably be a good one.
Well, yeah.
It's got food in it.
Ever James writes, Dear Crate and Crowbar, it's common to mention your favourite heroes from video games. It's also pretty common to mention your favourite villains. For games like Mass Effect, we often pick a favourite companion from the hero's party. But what about the villains' companions? Who's your favourite henchman, mini-boss, or Mrs. Evil Overlord from a video game? I pick Ultros from Final Fantasy VI, an evil octopus who famously tries to interrupt a performance by dropping an anvil on the lead singer. Final Fantasy VI is fucking great, as an aside. Who is this octopus? What made him evil? Why does he hate the theatre? Nobody knows. It adds a touch of whimsy and variety to an expansive, surprising game. Who would you pick, and what quality makes a good minor villain? Mini bosses, gentlemen. Good ones.
I want to know what the... this is a Nintendo game, but what the deal with the eggplant wizard is in Kid Icarus. Like, why is he an eggplant, for one thing? Why does he want to turn other people into eggplants? Is it like a fucking fetish? What is the... why would that be your aim? Like, you're just hanging around in what appears to be some kind of tomb/maze, turning people into eggplants. It's just an odd... It's an odd thing to do. Just kill them.
That is an odd thing to do. I was always very confused by Mental Block in Zool.
Yeah.
What the fuck was his game?
It was Mental
Apart
Block.
From the pun, obviously. That was clearly like the only reason that he existed. But what was going on?
He was a block and he was crazy.
A block who went wrong.
I'm struggling to think of like villain companions. As I said earlier, I don't play that many games with bosses in them, so I tend to selectively avoid those. So there aren't that many mini-bosses in the games I play, I feel like. Like, even Spelunky doesn't really have any mini-bosses. It's got the... Okay, my favourite boss's companion is the tribesmen who are worshipping Olmec at the end of Spelunky, because he immediately crushes them for worshipping
I like the little wizard from Resident Evil 4 who turns into a giant plant-like tentacle monster when you instigate his castle. He's a good kind of mini-boss. And also, like...
What was that? What was it for him?
What are you doing?
I'm really bad. Well, that's the truth of the whole entire Resident Evil series. Like, all these people are like, now you've come to my castle, now I'm going to turn into a horrible oily sausage monster. Why would you want that? That seems like that's a bad deal for you.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to kill you with guns.
Exactly, like, if the little wizard dude had just let me through without turning into a giant, like, plant penis, I would have just carried on my way
I really like the hover torso in Jedi Knight.
The hover torso.
One of the bad guys was just like a hovering torso. He like lost his whole lower body in some Jedi accident, probably. Yeah. And so he would just hover around. It was, I think it was a shitty boss fight because he was flying, and all flying enemies are terrible.
Mm.
But he was a distinctive character who stuck in my memory. There were like they had some quite characterful bosses in that. Like all of the. It was a kind of mini boss structure. You would, in each section, you were, I think, working towards defeating a certain evil Jedi, and that evil Jedi would be someone with an actual personality who would be in cutscenes and stuff. And they probably weren't great characters, but they, like, at least they stuck in my memory to some extent.
I'm going to read this from Damien from Australia, who writes, "Dear Koalas and Kookaburras, good day from Australia, mates."
Well themed.
Yeah, really, on point there.
On point there, on fleek. And I'm going to truncate this a little bit, I'm afraid, Damien, because we're running out of time. But I will open this first paragraph. In episode 103, it was mentioned that no one on the podcast had been to Australia, and that it was visualised as a desert that was full of things that can kill you.
Surely not. That's racial stereotyping.
You'll be pleased to know that this is simply not true. We have plenty of water and green landscapes also filled with things that can kill you, such as sharks, jellyfish, crocodiles, and even kangaroos who look like they've been lifting heavy at the gym. He attaches a photo that, if we can recover it from the email.
It is a really hench kangaroo.
Fucking hell, we should get that in the show notes. My question is, what game mechanic did you only discover significantly deep into a game which you have either improved or ruined the experience you had taken from the game so far? Was it the fault of the game designer who failed to reveal this mechanic in a suitable manner? Was it your fault, the player, for not experimenting with the parameters of the game? He also writes about Rocket League, and he talks about our discussion last week, I think, where we were talking about double jumping in Rocket League and how that affects your trajectory and stuff. Apparently he hadn't quite realised that you could double jump. And that was realisation.
Yeah, change. I don't think I would have known that had somebody not told me, actually.
And there you go.
I'm sure it was in the tutorial.
Probably.
So I think who plays the tutorial? Like, I think about 90% of people probably skip the tutorial and just try and play a game. And he says, I double tapped the jump button, and to my surprise, my rocket power car double jumped. I spent the whole match double jumping around, working out how the new mechanic behaved, probably to the disgust of my teammates, who probably wanted a bit more play from me. And he says, thanks for producing such a wonderful podcast, and thank you, Damien, for the question.
I remember in Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis, it turns out, I can't imagine how this control scheme worked, but the punching, I feel I might be misremembering this, but I feel like the punching was, you press the number keys, because there was a cheat, basically, that I discovered genuinely by myself. I didn't like look it up or anything, where if you held down the 0 key and then pressed the 9 key, Indy would do a sucker punch, where he like grabbed them and did an uppercut, and it knocked anyone out in one hit. It just solved all the fights in the game, except one. And there's just one fight where like this really like butch German dude has singled you out, and you have a fight with him, and if you try that, he has a special line of dialogue for if you try that cheat on him, and he says, that trick won't work with me, Mr. Jones, or whatever. And then you have to carry on playing the fight normally. And that was a bizarre mechanic that I didn't know was there until I discovered it, and I guess it kind of ruined the game in many ways.
I thought I had an example for this, but I knew I couldn't quite remember it, so I voted for this question on the basis that I would remember it by this time. I haven't.
You don't know what game it was? Or?
I remember there being something about, I think it might be one of the Ghost Recon games, but that one of the earlier Ghost Recon games that turned out on PC. I think the build of it I played didn't have any kind of quick save feature, and I remember hammering it for it in the review, only for it to turn out that it did have a quick save feature upon release, but I was unable to check whether the version that I had for it actually did in the end have that.
There's I don't know if this really counts, but like Axiom Verge, I got the grappling hook in that, and I tried using it. I didn't know there was a grappling hook in it until I got it, and then when I got it, I was like, oh my god, there's a grappling hook in this game, this is fantastic. I was already enjoying it, I thought this is the turning point, it would be one of my favourite games ever. And I tried to use it, and I almost just rage quit immediately. Like, just on the first attempt to use it, I was just like, what the fucking fuck, what the fuck. I've never had something annoy me so fast, so much. And it's like, you attach the grappling hook, and then you don't swing at all by default, and then you have to press left or right to swing. And then, if you're still holding left, when you reach the apex, or just when you start swinging, he disconnects the grapple automatically. So just trying to swing makes you cut the rope. And it's just like, what the fuck? What the hell? How can this possibly be right? And this is not how I expect grappling hooks to work. And I'm imagining this sort of like physics-y grappling hook where you swing at a certain distance and you can retract or pay it out and detach at a time of your choice. And then the challenge becomes to detach at the exact right time to get the maximum sideways velocity to get to where you want to go. And so at first I just thought this was the worst thing in the world and I was actually going to quit playing the game forever. And then
I thought, the worst thing in the world.
Yeah, literally the worst crime ever committed by any human in any context. And then I thought, oh, well, I can't actually remember why I went back to it. I think I was maybe not giving it another chance.
I thought that was Batman not having too small text on the prompts. Are you saying there's something worse than that?
In my opinion, I mean, I haven't played it on PS4.
Worse than both the Holocaust and that?
Perhaps. Anyway, what I eventually figured out was that it's not really a physically grappling hook. It's more like a kind of jump booster. And really, you just do a jump, and then you press the grappling hook button, and you just keep on holding the direction that you want to go in. And the grappling hook connects, swings you in that direction, and then automatically disconnects at the exact, like, extremity of your jump. Which is not the right time to disconnect if it was physics-based, because at the extremity of your jump, you have no velocity. It's at the bottom of your jump that you have the most actual lateral velocity, and at the extremity of your jump, that's when you've lost your velocity and you're about to swing back, so it'd be stupid to disconnect.
Worms 2 literally solved this. Worms 2 had the best swinging system.
But it's kind of, the reason this question reminded me of it is because once you know how to use it, it's actually a really useful tool, and it just lets you jump a bit further. It's almost idiot-proof once you know how to use it, because you just hold down one key. There's no skill to it. There's a skill to when to actually attach it, because you have to choose which bit of roof you want to attach to, and you've got to do that at the right time you're going to jump. But after you've attached it, the swinging process is not like any other grappling hook. It's just you hold down the direction you want to go in, and you'll go there to the maximum extent that you can.
Yeah. I would put forward Ikaruga, which has a very positive version of this, where merely completing the game as an ordinary human is only half the game, because just staying alive isn't really what it's all about. It's about getting a high score. And the way you get high scores in Ikaruga is by killing enemies in threes. And all enemies in Ikaruga are either light polarity or dark polarity. And you have shields in Ikaruga, which let you switch between light polarity or dark polarity. And if you are the same polarity as the enemy fire, then you will just absorb their bullets and turn it to missiles. If you're the opposite polarity, you're killed in one hit. So surviving this is incredibly difficult. It's an amazing game in many ways. But as soon as you realise that in order to get the highest possible scores, you have to kill in threes of like three red, three red, three white, three red, three white, three white. Doesn't matter what order. As long as you're killing in threes, it's fine. Then you start to notice that every level throughout the entire game has been designed around that principle. And you never even notice it if you're just trying to survive the game. You don't realise that, of course, enemies come in you know, multiples of 12 or multiples of 3 throughout. Or the fact that these huge carriers, which have these have 8 kind of mini turrets on the sides that you can then blow off, and then you destroy the central craft afterwards to get a 3 chain of 9. And it'll throw 2 of these things at you at the same time, and they're throwing out loads and loads of bullets. But suddenly the entire game becomes this mathematical challenge of kind of how do you get squeeze threes out of this scenario. And then suddenly you start noticing things the game designers have left in there to let you get extra chains that you would never ever have noticed if you were just playing to survive the game. So there's a little block puzzle section where there are red and white blocks moving around you, and of course, like, you can destroy red blocks faster with white bullets, etc, etc. And there are just loads of just blocks around the side, and you think they're just filling the width of the level with blocks. But when you go through looking for max scores, they're points. So you're looking at ways to get all those tertiary extra little blocks, and then suddenly the entire level just behaves completely differently. That happens so often in Ikaruga. And brilliantly, your fully charged rocket burst, which homes in on the nearest 12 enemies, 12 of course, because it gives you a chain, encourages you to snipe out in certain sections all of, for example, the dark enemies, leaving just 12 white enemies within your blast radius. And there are these beautiful moments where you've just like done this beautiful sniping move, and then just bosh, all those homing missiles go out. You see your chain just go up, and you hear your machine murmuring to you about how amazing you are.
Are there people who have max scored Ikaruga on the YouTubes?
There are people, and not only that, there are people who have done it on arcade machines, playing two player, one player with each hand. And what? That is what I'm going to send you the link after you can put it in the show notes, because that is fucking bullshit. It's amazing. It's amazing because co-op in Ikaruga is extraordinary, because of course you can hold a dark player behind a white player, and you know that's a shield for the dark player to deal double damage to everyone else who he's firing past. Like, so you can use the player in front of you to shield yourself, but it requires extraordinary coordination between two players. Unless you happen to be the same person with one brain, and apparently the left side, like hemisphere of your brain, is controlling the right stick, and the right side is controlling the left stick. And then you know this guy is just ridiculous.
Does Ikaruga do something special with like enemies coming from the side versus the front or something? I feel like it came up in a discussion that I was having on Twitter about the virtues of side-on versus top-down, because I sort of like top-down better. And then I think actually it was Reagan of Metanet, the end creators, who said that he liked, I think it was Ikaruga, because usually the reason he prefers side-on games is that the two dimensions are fundamentally different. The vertical dimension is fundamentally different to the horizontal one. Horizontal one, you can move freely. Vertical one, there's gravity.
Hmm.
Right? And in a top-down game, X and Y are sort of interchangeable. They don't have any special properties.
Yeah.
And I feel like he was talking about some shoot 'em up, and I thought it was Ikaruga that used the side was completely different to top in some way.
No, I think...
Fair enough.
I don't think there's much difference. It's just, it finds a lot of ways of throwing patterns at you by ambushing you from the sides in ways that is occasionally bullshit. It's the way, like, I'd mark Ikaruga down, in fact did, for the fact that, like, in phase 4, it just ambushes you with bullshit attacks from the sides. Like, the walls come in ways that you could never possibly predict based on any of the things that have happened to you up until that point. And it's just a kind of rote repetition by which you learn that. And that's kind of a bullshit way of learning things, and you should be able to do things better. But apart from that, it's fucking amazing. And almost impossible. And with that, that's all the questions we have questions for.
Which were also fucking amazing and nearly impossible.
As we proved. Anyway, if you'd like to follow us on Twitter, you can follow the Crate and Crowbar account at Crate and Crowbar. If you'd like to join our lovely forum full of lovely people, you can go to crateandcrowbar.com/forum.
You can send us more questions.
Yes, please do. And we have a Patreon account, of course, which you can find linked on our website, www.crateandcrowbar.com. And I forgot the URL.
Email for questions is questions@crateandcrowbar.com.
Great. We'll just give you these in just a completely random
crowdsourcing our.
There's also a donate button if you feel like giving us a few quid or whatever. And you can also follow us individually, of course. Marsh?
I'm at Marsh Davis. That's DAVIES.
And Tom?
I'm at Pentadact, PentaDact.
And I'm at PCGLudo, LUDO.
Something we completely forgot to mention during the main podcast was that we received a very nice email from a young lady asking us to wish a happy birthday to her big brother, Jacob Rose. So happy birthday, Jacob Rose. Sorry we didn't mention you in the main podcast, but we were really quite drunk.